But in a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Castle.
There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand. Defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso. In a tower by the river. Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
Welcome to another edition of the Chicago Way. This is John Cass, your mild-mannered, syndicated columnist at the Chicago Tribune. I see other people say it, so why shouldn't I? Chicago Tribune, Jeff Carlin, the excellent, probably the best producer in radio, and I'm not kidding, who produces the Rokon and Anna show on WGN. Later on, we're going to have Tom Bevan from Real Clear Politics to talk about the state of the republic. I mean, if you want to have Trump sucks, Trump doesn't suck, Republicans are good, Democrats are good, if you want that kind of discussion, you're coming to the wrong place. Uh-oh. We don't deal with cartoons here.
Well, Scott Sanis does, but he'll be by later.
We deal with cartoons from a cartoonist. Scott Sanis will be here, right, from the Chicago Tribune award-winning cartoonist who actually does cartoons.
Right, exactly.
You know,
good cartoons.
Very good ones.
And, John, for the 13-year-old in all of us, I'd like to commemorate this episode as our 69th episode.
Nice. I'm not going to say it.
I had to.
All right, a couple things. Get them off my chest. Number one, leave me alone with the rabbits, okay? I told everybody it was going to come. I told them what happened. I saved some rabbits. Are you going to, what?
So the place you took them to, is it like a library or like a bank where like you put the rabbits in young and then you take them back fat and later and then make stew out of them? Is that what
the Animal Welfare League is a great story. People should go out there to see. There should be reporters doing it. They actually take strays. Some of the so-called like the posh animal love places don't take strays. They don't take strays. And I think strays is part of the thing if you care about animals, because there are a lot of stray animals. So they've taken, they have that foul-mouthed parrot. Dr. Burns tells me the parrot now, I think he has 5,000 swear words, I think. But, you know, he's in the back, so he can't. So children can't hear him. They have a pig. Someone brought in a pig. They've got cougars. They have my five rabbits. They have several 100 dogs and cats that people bring in, and they find homes for them, and I think they do good work. What I liked about it was like the people's animal shelter. I was there, it was on Chicago Ridge on the Southwest Highway, and when I grew up. I just had a sense, these are all working people, not really rich. Maybe they don't come down to North Michigan Avenue to shop. They love their dogs and their cats and their pets, and people were helping them, and I just like that. But there's something that's out there now that you could go to and see that's not like that. And I'm not generally the movie critic. We have a movie critic, excellent one, Michael Phillips, and Rich Roper, your buddy, over at the Sun-Times is excellent. But I'm going to tell you about a movie, and I hope you see it. Dunkirk. 400,000 men at the beach. France, 24 miles away from England. They were trapped there. They were about to be slaughtered. Basically, a great part of the British Army. Trapped and about to be killed. And the heroic efforts of their commanders and the men and the people who came by boat, fishing boats,
civilians.
Pleasure boats, civilians. You know, I saw one shot where there was a woman, you know, with a tweed jacket on and kind of sturdy shoes and a proper skirt. Middle class people. People with a little bit of means. They had a boat, or fishing people coming over to load up those sailors and bring them home. I have not seen a movie like this in quite some time. Jeff, Dunkirk is worth the money.
Yeah, Richard Roper says one of the easy contender for picture of the year.
Why did he like it?
Well, for that, I mean, one, it's Nolan from the Batman trilogy.
Christopher Nolan, great director.
Yeah, great stuff. I mean, a lot of good stuff. The cinematography of it was great. I mean, that alone was just top notch. But the story and the vivid nature of telling such a kind of forgotten story, or maybe a story that people just aren't relevant to their lives, or they just aren't aware of it.
Well, especially in America, how would Americans stand on a beach waiting to die in orderly fashion? Now, how would those kids with the video showing the man dying and laughing, or the other ones? And not just those kids. How about any kids or all of us that we crowd around a multicultural group of idiots who, like, barge into stores and trample each other?
Right.
On
Black Friday.
How would they stand in line orderly while waiting to die with the Germans coming over the hill? How could that be? And I think, you know, later on we're going to talk about issues and how cultures lose sometimes the means to even describe the problems that they're facing. And in this one, I was in Dunkirk by Christopher Nolan. I was struck by the people, how the Brits waited. Some of them tried to get off the beach. It's natural, but it wasn't chaos. It wasn't panic. And there was one other thing about it, and I'm not spoiling the movie for you. You really must see it. And don't see it at a late show. See it at an early show when you're awake and you've had your coffee and you're not tired from the day. Give the day to this movie. This is how good of a movie it is. It deserves for you to point your day at that movie, not as some afterthought. What got me, Jeff, there was no big speech. You know the big speech in the war movie?
Sure.
You turn and you look at your men. And either you have Braveheart, that was a great movie. I'm not saying it wasn't a great movie. But it's become in everything. And any time you have a enterprise and you're the underdogs and pressure's on, somebody makes a speech in movies. It wasn't a speech. Not then, not on the beach. There were speeches later, including one by Winston Churchill that is quite remarkably read by one of the soldiers, so you don't even hear Churchill's voice in that famous, "We shall fight in the beaches, we shall fight on the landing grounds, they will always be in England," one of the great, great, great speeches by a leader in Western culture. But, Jeff, I have to say, the sense of detail, the sound, story, and the understated nature of the people. There are moments between a father and a son as they go to do their duty, as they believe, to help their people. And the father takes the boat and they leave the dock before the British Navy can requisition it, because he's saying, this is my boat, this is my country, I'm going to help our people. And many, many Brits did this. And it gave me the feeling of after 9/11, when people showed kindness and love for each other. And so much is going through my mind now. Can we ever find that? Is that what we need? A war to bind us? I don't want people to die. But I'm not glorifying it. I don't think war is great. I've never been in one, thank God. But it just the reserve, the kindness and the reserve and the love of country that the British people expressed in this movie without the big speech and without a lot of talking about it. There's no talking about it. There's just doing. I hope that everyone listening to this will go see it. Christopher Nolan, Dunkirk. Joining us now is my friend and co-founder and president, publisher of the Real Clear Politics Empire, and he also drives around people around. I saw him with Molly Hemingway from The Federalist in a cab, in a van, driving around captive writers and politicians, asking them questions on video. None other than Tom Bevin. Good morning, Tom.
Hey, John, how are you?
Fine, thank you. Who are you driving around lately?
I drove Carl Cannon around. We're promoting his new book, which just came out this week, called On This Date. It's a collection of his morning notes that he sends out every morning. And it's great, actually. It's a fantastic book. It's unlike anything that you've ever read.
We'll have 365
micro stories, John. Not even short stories, micro stories. 450 words each that are, I'll have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and they're great.
All right, and I get them in the morning on email. I used to get them on email, I think. I haven't gotten them recently. Maybe I've dropped off his email list, but I'll still have them on the podcast. Would be great to talk to him.
You should.
In the meantime, I've got a proposition, okay?
Okay.
If Donald Trump, President Trump, and I'm speaking, I guess, as a never Hillary, hashtag never Clinton voter. If Donald Trump gets rid of Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller, and if he cuts loose Attorney General Jeff Sessions, is his presidency effectively over?
That is a good question. I don't know. This interview... What was fascinating about this interview he gave to the New York Times is that he doesn't need the New York Times. He didn't need to go to the New York Times to bash his attorney general or bash Bob Mueller. He could have done that on Twitter. In fact, he does most of the time on Twitter. Mm-hmm. So why did he do this with the New York Times? And there are two ways of thinking about that. One is he went to the New York Times to sort of lay the predicate for, a Saturday Night Massacre type cleaning house, right? Fire all these guys. Rosenstein, McCabe, Mueller, and even possibly Sessions. But even that doesn't necessarily make sense. I mean, again, he doesn't need the New York Times to necessarily do that. The other option is that he was just telling the truth. I mean, this guy, Trump has issues with, sometimes he says things that are inflated, sometimes he says things that are incorrect, but he also has this reputation for candor and just saying what's on his mind. He'll answer questions in a very sort of blunt way. And I think that's what happened here. He was asked about Sessions and he just said, I just thought it was a unfair thing to do. I'm sure he's told Sessions that in private, probably a number of times. Hey, what the heck were you doing? Why did you do that? That was just unnecessary. This whole Russia thing's stupid. And you just caved into to these guys. I mean, that's not, Trump is famous for wanting his folks to fight back and hit back harder and never apologize. So I don't know. I mean, I do think if Bob Mueller if his investigation sort of runs wild, I think Trump would fire him. I think Trump would get rid of him and replace him.
And then what happens?
Well, I don't know.
Presidency? I don't mean does he get, will the media and the Democrats hate him anymore because they already do. And it's evident. I mean, every time I read something in the Washington Post lately, since before Trump even was elected, but particularly since November, everything I read in the Washington Post seems to be dripping with invective. So they're not going to change. But would his policy agenda be crippled if it's not crippled already?
I think it would definitely increase the firestorm and the pressure and the distraction that's going on, because part of what's, I mean, you're right. I mean, Democrats already want him gone and they'd vote to remove him immediately. It's Republicans that would be the question, right? What would they do? Would they send somebody marching up to the White House to say, look, buddy, you know, you can't do this or you've gone too far and we're going to break with you? And, he'd have to have, he really have to have a mutiny of Republicans on his hands. And I'm not sure that's where they want to go. But I agree. I mean, look, he's been advised not to do this, and I think it would be a big problem for him if he did. But, I think it would further hamper his ability to sort of get things done, in part because I think Republicans would be just beside themselves, some of these folks on the Hill, and it would make it harder for them, I think, to get behind him and his agenda and some of the things that he wants to get done.
One of the things I've stopped trying to convince liberal wackos who read my column is that I'm not a Trump guy. They keep saying your guy Trump. I guess that means if you're not for Hillary, you're for Trump. However, my greatest concern really isn't for the Trump administration as much as what happens in the post-Trump period. Either 4 years from now or 3 years from now or 8 years from now, are we getting in a place in the Republic where if a Democrat gets elected through in a populist wave, all bets are off? The kind of media treatment that Trump received will be given to the Democrat in a, you know, from whatever remaining conservatives there are in the media by then? And what happens to the Republic, to those people, tens and tens of millions, who voted for Trump hoping that he would fight the establishment and now seeing the establishment fighting back and crippling him? What is the outcome for the Republic, Professor?
Well, look, there are two ways of thinking about that as well. One is that Trump is sort of he's an anomaly. He's an aberration. This is not the new normal. He's uniquely divisive. He's, you know, and when he's gone, whether it's 4 years, 8 years, sooner than that, that we will revert back to sort of the traditional, more conventional politicians.
Right.
I mean, Trump.
Bernie? More conventional?
Well, not necessarily like that, but just more. I mean, Trump defied so many political norms. He got away with so much stuff, saying things that normal politicians just couldn't get away with. And the question is, you know, whoever's going to come after Trump, would they be able to, are they going to have those same qualities or were those unique to him? And I think the answer to that is he's a unique figure in that sense. And, you know, if Marco Rubio runs next time, he's not going to be able to get away with saying half the stuff that Trump said or the campaign the way Trump campaigned.
Crystal will love him, and so will all the neocons, and we'll have another war. Boots on the ground in Syria. Let's go. Right.
Well, there are a couple different threads here, too. I mean, on one hand, you've got this trend toward celebrity, you know, you've got Kid Rock in Michigan, you've got Wayne the Rock Johnson, you know, talking about 2020. You've got all sorts of, I think Trump has maybe opened the door for people who had previously not thought about running for politics to think about running. And I think that's actually a good thing. I don't have a problem with that. The Democrats, however, do have a problem, and they don't, for as much as people say Trump hasn't gotten anything done in the last 6 months, the Democrats have not gotten any closer to figuring out what their problem was with middle class voters in November. They are 6 months in. They are no closer. They're not figuring it out. I mean, they're elevating Maxine Waters, you know, is showing up in New Hampshire and talking about how much millennials love her and how she's going to fight Trump and throw shade and all this stuff.
Right.
If the Democrats are going to make Maxine Waters the face of the national party, they are in for a rude awakening. They are in for a world of hurt.
Exactly.
And, you know, Kamala Harris is another one that folks are talking about her as a potential 2020 candidate. And, you know, again, I see the allure of Democrats trying to run somebody who doesn't have a national profile, doesn't have a voting record. You know, she's sort of the young, fresh face and all that.
We did that in 2008 and see how that turned out.
We did. And, you know, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren. I mean, these are the leading lights of the Democratic Party right now. And, they just unveiled. Did you see their new slogan that they unveiled the other day?
Which? Look at the other guy? Something like that?
No, that was one.
That was a couple weeks ago.
It's a better deal, better wages, better work, better jobs, something like that.
Yeah.
And, some wag on Twitter snarkily referred to it as it's like a Papa John's ad. I mean, it's just ridiculous. And so I don't think Democrats are any closer to figuring out the political dynamics in this country than some Republicans are, who still look at Trump and what he did and who's supporting him, and the folks that are still, you know, sticking with him through all this and wondering, you know, what they need to do and where they need to go.
Okay, so there's my point. So then where's the Republic when you have the so-called elites of both political parties grappling with realities that they can't even put words around to describe it to themselves so that they can take action? That is a very dangerous thing.
I totally agree. I mean, in some ways you can feel the country. I mean, we've been in a divided country since the 2000 election and the Supreme Court decision and all that. It's gotten very, very tribal and continues to get worse. I think Donald Trump's election took it to a different level because Democrats just absolutely lost their minds.
And
Trump voters, and well, that's the thing. And the media is so discredited now because they spent 8 years sort of looking the other way when Barack Obama did something. And now, you know, everything that Trump does is a 5-alarm fire and some sort of impeachable offense that half the country just doesn't trust them, doesn't listen to them, has contempt for them. And so, you know, I can see a situation if Democrats get somebody back. And I mean, will they get the same treatment? Of course not. And that's only going to further the distrust and the anger. And so, I don't see the country coming back together anytime soon. It's going to take some sort of special, you know, some sort of special event, some sort of special individual to be able to do that. Otherwise, I think, you know, we're spinning further and further apart. Now, I don't know where that leads to secession and civil war, you know, cold war within the states. I don't know. But it's certainly it is a disturbing trend, especially when you talk about people losing faith in the institutions that have held this country together, whether it's the Supreme Court, it's Congress, it's the media, it's colleges and universities. I mean, it's public schools, it's state legislatures, it's
police.
Governors. police. Yeah. I mean, there's just a lot of anger and mistrust for a lot of the institutions, and that will not end well for us.
And Tom, on the media thing, how do you think we get back to the idea of ethical media, or at least media that isn't just, well, somebody talked to me and I'm going to take that idea and I'm going to run with it? You know, I've got a source that I know is telling me the truth because they wouldn't lie to me, which is seeming to be everything we're seeing now.
Because David Rhodes wouldn't lie to the media.
Right. And it's so that you've got this nonsense. So how do we get back to that? I mean, is it through, for you know, certifications or some sort of I mean, I'm just spitballing, John. Thanks for that, John. John just looked at me like I had a penis drawn on my forehead. we've got to get back to that. We've
government
fix
license
the
for columnists. Yes, that's it.
I mean, or some way to hold people accountable for not doing their job correctly, like you would a pilot. If a pilot screws up, you're no longer a pilot.
Yeah, I mean, that's not going to happen. I mean, so many people in the media have been so wrong about so many things, and they just continue to opine and declare, opinions about things, and nobody ever is held accountable. I mean, the public's memory is very, very short for that kind of thing. Look, I there has been, I think, a great fiction that has been revealed, and that was that in the aftermath of Watergate, that the press was objective and, you know, going to speak truth to power and, you know, hold them accountable and all that. And these were the gatekeepers of truth, honesty, and objectivism in the media.
The Knights of Virtue. And
the Knights of Virtue. And there were three of them at the time, right? The anchors of the three major television networks and some of these, you know, scribes from these papers. There were just a handful of people that were controlling what people were reading, seeing, how the news was fashioned, shaped, presented to the American public. And now, with the demise of newspapers, the rise of the internet and all these things, we have a completely different media environment, which is in some ways much better and in some ways worse, because we have plenty of other viewpoints, plenty of other avenues and places to get information. Mixed in with that, we have, you know, phony information. We have, you know, websites that are satire that get picked up as real news. We have, you know, the fake news thing with people spreading disinformation purposefully. But in the mix of all that, I think what people have come to understand is that folks who have said, many of the folks who have claimed to be the Knights of Virtue, as John just said, turns out they weren't being objective and virtuous. They had their thumbs on the scales and were actively rooting in the press box for specific team. And so I think we've done away with that fiction, and we're back to maybe where we were before and where the press in this country started, which was advocacy journalism. And you just have to know when you sit down. I mean, I know the folks at the Washington Post and New York Times hate it when people talk like this and say, you know, you just have to understand when you read their stories, you're accepting, you know, they're presenting things from a certain perspective, a certain point of view. Sometimes it's obvious, sometimes it's not as obvious. But as long as news consumers know that, they're still able to, I think, read the New York Times and evaluate the news that's being presented there in a sort of, you know, fair-minded way. You can say, look, and we've all read a dozen stories in the New York Times in probably the last 2 or 3 weeks where you just look at it and you're like, this is total crap. I mean, it's you know, anonymous, it's blind sources, it's hearsay, it's innuendo, it's being presented as fact, it's not. So I think news consumers, at least some, have become more savvy and able to sort of discern the landscape of news. So, but I don't, we're certainly not going to some sort of, and that's the other thing, you know, Jeff, is like the quote unquote fact checkers. I mean, that's just a fiction as well. I mean, the folks who are fact checking, you know, have been found to be, they're not necessarily objective either, although they present themselves as being such. So there's no accreditation process. There's no certification that's going to happen. I mean, that's just not, that'll never happen. If anything, we're going in the other direction, and folks are sort of left up to their own devices to sort through it and figure it out.
Yeah, there was a fiction perpetuated by Lou Grant, one of the worst TV shows in the history of American entertainment, and others where there was sort of a dispassionate, nonpartisan view of the world, but it did have a crusader aspect to it, and crusaders generally cleave to people who are going to spend my money on their causes so my taxes go up. I would suggest to both of you and everyone who's reading or listening here to read a piece in the American Conservative by Robert W. Mary. It's rather long. It involves a kind of a comparison between the fall of Rome and the United States. But I think it's worth looking at, particularly because it speaks to what Tom has been saying, sort of a corrosive, acidic corrosiveness that's happening to the institutions of the country, which are irrespective. I mean, they're separate from Trump. Trump didn't create that. There's something else driving it. What was interesting about the piece, and I want both of you guys to weigh in on this, he mentioned that at some point societies don't even have they think their culture is working, their polity is working, but they think there are problems in it. But because of the nature of how human beings think and cultures respond, they often can't even get the vocabulary and the necessary to frame the problem until it's far too late, and then it's a matter for historians, not for those living in the time. And I think, in a way, what Tom's been talking about with our media and our understanding of our culture and our politics is part of that. Okay. In other words, you guys were doing playing Sudoku when I was talking, or what?
Okay. No. Listen, John, I agree with that. And I'll have to read Mary's piece because I haven't. But I do think, you know, when you talk about the fabric of our society, that we now, I think that the way that, and I don't want to lay all the blame on at the foot of Democrats, but certainly for for the last, you know, couple of decades at least, and maybe longer, Democrats have approached our politics by, you know, constituent dividing folks up into different constituencies, right? With which they want to speak to. And whether it's, you know, African Americans or Hispanics or you know, gays or whatever, environmentalists, I mean, all the different sort of constituencies that represent the Democratic Party. And I think that has that's one of the reasons they lost touch with middle America and folks all around the country, you know, sort of everyday workaday folks, Democrats and Republicans in the heartland of this country. And, you know, I think Republicans also did the same thing, only in a different way. I mean, they lost touch because they would talk about things like free trade and just assume that everybody, it was great. It's a universal good. And if you question that, you know, sit down and shut up. Right. To the folks in Ohio, and their only answer then was, "Well, we'll get you some retraining." Meanwhile, their family structures are falling apart. There's no jobs. Communities are hollowed out. So, you know, Republicans, I think, also politically had a massive blind spot for the last, you know, 20, 30, 40 years. Another one is foreign policy. You mentioned sort of neoconservatism. I mean, there's just plenty of folks around the country that were fed up with the idea that we're going to continue to send our men and women overseas for, you know, what a lot of folks thought was insanity. And we're building roads and bridges and schools over in trying to deliver democracy to these countries when the roads and bridges and schools of middle class, you know, towns around this country were crumbling. So I think both parties have missed the boat politically over the last 20, 30 years. And as a result, I mean, we have gotten more divided as a country, and there doesn't seem to be anything that's really unifying us as a country anymore. There's no great national project. There's no call to service. There's no space program. There's none of the things that we've had in the past that have really brought out our common humanity. We don't have any of those things anymore, and I think that's a problem.
The left, I'm coming, I guess as I get older, the more conservative I become, but with a, not with a Republican aspect. But I do see the left as it was trying to succeed over the past 30, 40 years, deconstruct a lot of the institutions that worked, or at least worked against their purposes. And as a result, now I think after deconstructing the family, social institutions, etc. Now, there used to be something called in Rome, it was the way of our fathers. It was understood. In here, it was called the American way. Whatever that really meant, it was some sort of unifying principle that we didn't, you know, our politics stopped at the shores of the United States, etc., etc. All that's out the window. And I think as we grasp to try to find some unifying principle, it just keeps, it's like it's not even there, and we keep, it's ephemeral, and we keep reaching for it as if it's some sort of, you know, as a like a light, like swamp gas or something, and we're trying to grab it, and we can't. And that's the problem.
I agree with all that, John, except I'm going to have to, you know, I'm not sure how conservative you are anymore, because you know, I want you to know I've nominated you to be PETA's Man of the Year for saving baby rabbits. And I just think that, you know, that could bring your conservative credentials into question when you're crowned that.
I have to say, it reminded me of my favorite of a show that I watched when I was a boy called Branded with Chuck Connors, where Chuck Connors is an officer in the United States Army, and he's kicked out, and they break his sword, and he's thrown out, and all my hunting friends are calling me a wimp, and the gardeners, the gardeners are saying, "You five rabbits will become 50,000 in a matter of months, and it's your fault." And you know, Tom. But on the other hand, as a publisher, let me ask you: would you want one of your, you know, your cash cow prop or writers going around putting baby rabbits on a skewer and eating them and telling people what he'd done? Right?
No, probably not. Since when have you ever cared about public opinion, John?
When it comes to rabbits, I had what I didn't say, I wanted them dead, okay? But when an editor said, "Can you take a video of the hawk eating the rabbit?" And he was joking, but I knew that in the back of his mind, he was thinking clicks, because it would have been so National Geographic. And then it would be Jeff Carlin's colleague, Ro Khan, on the radio, ripping me for allowing to, you know, and it would have been terrible.
I think you should have installed a hawk nest, so something that's good for the hawks. Not so good for the rabbits, but
right,
good for the
hawks. Exactly. But if you want any more gardening tips, please call me, and I'll make sure that I should have sent them to you, Tom Bevan. You have so many kids here. They would have loved to have bottle-fed the babies.
I'm sure. That's what we need.
All right, if I get some more, I'll put them in a shoebox, but appropriately enough, you
with
know, something like with holes, like a Johnson & Murphy shoebox, so you'll recognize it, and or an Allen Edmonds shoebox, and it'll be right there for you, okay?
Okay.
Thanks a lot,
John.
Tom.
I appreciate it.
Thanks,
Daddy.
All right, you know, a few minutes ago, didn't we say that this is not a show about political cartoons? But I didn't mean it in the context of our guest, Scott Stannis, award-winning cartoonist
yeah.
in the Chicago Tribune.
What were you talking about?
We were saying, you know,
caricatures, really.
Caricatures,
is probably
like
the better
Trump,
word choice.
You know, I mean, some of journalism now is Trump sucks. You suck because you liked him. I read that often. In certain publications.
Yes.
And then it's Hillary, the Democrats suck, and you suck if you like them.
Yeah.
I mean, that seems to be the discourse. And I said it was cartoonish, not cartoons the way you.
Sure. I came to your defense, Scott.
Yes. Oh.
Thank you, Jeff.
And Polly, John did not whitewash the fence. And Polly, I bet you no one knows what we're saying because you know
you can't read that
anymore. Our audience is literate. What?
You can't read that anymore.
You can't read Tom Sawyer
or Huck Finn.
Oh yeah. Well, Jim, what can I say?
This is bad language and racial stereotyping. You can't do that.
Oh, well, I'm.
And it's gender specific. You can't do that either. It's all cis stuff.
Because boys. Yeah, because boys are kind of like the rulers of those books.
That's right.
Now boys have to be, now I see books now where boys have to defer.
I'm going to go back and reread The Hardy Boys and see if, under my, now that I'm an adult and I understand how the world really is, I'm going to critique them.
Really?
How the world really
is. That would be good because I'm a dad. So think of yourself as a dad and the two boys go, "Hey, Dad, we're going to go fight the underworld right now. We're just going to go, okay, boys, I'm just going to smoke a pipe and watch you go down to the docks."
Wily kids, so he's solving crimes.
Right?
Yeah. Could you imagine contemporary Chicago Hardy boys? we're going to go investigate the shooting. Hey, what's that?
We should do the
Hardy Boys.
Yeah.
He's already, knowing Jeff Carlin, he's already thinking about a bit for the Ro Khan show with the Hardy, right? Tell me it didn't flash through
it
your
mind. It
did
a little bit, yeah.
It did, right?
It did. Although, our very own Brian Altimer, who you guys both know, I don't know if you saw the story, but there was that shooting, the uncle of the University of Wisconsin assistant basketball coach and former head coach at UIC, Leroy Moore, was shot, and Brian got off the train right in the front of the aftermath of it. Like it was a drive-by between two cars shooting out, and he was on the street corner, and luckily one street corner versus the other one.
At the Ryan?
Yeah, 63rd and State.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so he witnesses firsthand. So now Brian thinks Chicago needs a Batman, and he's volunteering.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, he'd be a great Batman.
He would be a great Batman, but I keep
Well, we already have Zorro.
Soro, right.
Because the mayor is fighting for the, you know, undocumented workers.
Well, to be fair, he's in Europe. He dare defends our cheese.
Right.
I mean, right? Isn't
that- you know what people said? I got calls from people at City Hall. Who said, you know, your column about mocking the mayor for going to Italy and et cetera for the, what, loafers? Get some loafers around?
He's putting together the Three Musketeers.
They said that was cheap. Cheap shot. You guys can say, should the mayor be at work? Should he be in Italy and having his bromance with Mayor Khan of London and so forth?
Unless he's going to convince the Italians and the British to help us open our schools in the fall and end the violence and pay our bills, then he should be here dealing with it, not gallivanting.
Would you?
No, I totally agree. I thought it was a great column.
You were in Europe. Did you?
I was on vacation, though. I wasn't pretending.
He's also not in charge of this city.
But would you go on vacation? Here's the question.
In the summer of what happens in Chicago? Hell no. No, you're.
But you're a newspaper guy. Would you go on vacation? Like I asked an editor a couple weeks before the next big election, if I go take 2 weeks off, and they're like, "Pardon me, what?"
Yeah,
like could you, as the Tribune, the editorial cartoonist,
I wouldn't want to.
No,
that's when we work. That's our job description. That's the thing we're supposed to be doing.
To be fair, he couldn't go in the fall when the Laquan or the Van Dyke trial started because then he'd look really bad.
Oh, he'll go.
Oh, yeah.
I hear at that time, Rahm will go, he'll call.
He'll be in the space station.
Ari will help him get a bunch of stars, and they'll all do an HBO documentary called Alone. Or no, it'll be his History Channel. He'll go, like, Vancouver Island or something and camp out there, and you're going to have, who are the other Ari stars? You know, you're showbiz. Come on, you know. That he represents some other big players.
Yeah, I'm not up to speed on whatever who he represents. Well,
I just think of him alone in the forest with his bottle of wine, just dreaming of the happier days with Bruce Rauner
when they were friends.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, it's not easy being mayor, and I don't think he's as bad as some people say. I don't think he's as good as he says. I do think that he was dealt a scata sandwich, as we say, right? But he took it. He took it, and now he's the mayor, so stay at work.
Is he going to get reelected? I mean,
I think that's the untold political story in Chicago among many. One is his facility at keeping an African-American candidate from running against him. I don't see an African-American candidate. I guess it's an old formula, if I buy into that binary thinking, where... must be an African American. Could be someone else, but I don't see anyone, you know, raising money.
Well, your friend. Oh God! Oh my gosh! I'm
Tony Taxwinkle. She's having problems with Tom Dart. She's screaming at Tom Dart, right?
No, the Goo Goo Alderman. Wagasback.
He's not a Goo Goo. He's a good government.
No, I
Alderman.
Know. I'm just saying that. That's what I'm.
I always defend liberals when I like them. Well, he's my token liberal friend. No, I do. I like Scott. And he's a Fire fan.
Yeah. Well, and God, you're Fire. Holy Mary.
Right, I know. But go on with Scott Wagsback.
No, I think he's a great candidate. I really do. I mean, he's running. He announced his candidacy right here on this podcast.
Yeah, well, you were here, right?
I was sitting there. My gobsmacked. Yeah, but that's a story.
The problem was Scott's wife heard the podcast.
What happened?
Yeah, I don't know. Somebody.
I mean,
it's a little early.
Yeah, and he told us, too, that he's like, well, yeah, I would run. I really have to ask my wife first because, you know, I can't do this decision without her. And then later on, he's like, well, I'll think about it. So I'm assuming that conversation did not go.
Well, here's a little known thing I've never talked about publicly, but I was approached years ago. There's an open state Senate seat in the district I live in Alabama. And I was approached and they asked if I'd want to run for it. And I'd love to run for office someday. I think for public service. Also, I have an ego. So,
no.
Yes. So I talked to Janine, my wife, who I love above all others. And that run didn't happen. She just
was that
not
the governor who ended up shacking up with the weather girl?
Not a weather girl. She was,
the weather bunny? No? What was it?
A What the?
She's some hot TV chick or something.
Well, she'd done some TV stuff, but she became an aide. And
he's like 80 years old and wrinkly.
Oh, he looks like the Crypt Keeper.
And she's sort of alpha female of a certain age.
Yes, and he was forced out. He was effectively impeached. He resigned.
Was that the movie with Rita Hayworth? No. Okay, go on.
Anyway, yes. That's an old one. So I'm just saying that wives, if someone approached you to run for office, John, what would Ms. Betty say?
I think I might tell her what my decision would be. I'm sure we'd talk about it, but the main thing is I wouldn't run for office. I would run like Everett Dirksen. I would smoke, I would drink whiskey, and I'd say, do you want to vote for me or not? That's all. That's how he ran, and he won. Right?
Yeah.
Why? But if I ran for office, what would my slogan, what would your slogan be, Jeff Carlin? If you
rabbit in every pot?
You're not going to let go. Okay, so I found some baby rabbits.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's been busting me, Tom Bevin.
Why?
What?
Why are they busting you? That was a compassionate move.
Or was it like some people think it was like a cynical, weaselly columnist trick to lead people to think that I was going to kill them and at the last moment call my podiatrist for advice, Dr. Byrne, who said bring him to the animal.
Well, who doesn't do that?
Right? When you're in trouble, don't you call your moral dilemma? Call my podiatrist.
Yeah,
it was cynical. No, it wasn't. I'm not going to kill. I couldn't.
Oh gosh, no.
I know, John.
Come on.
What are you?
There was a
Jeff,
time.
Are you kidding?
What
is Jeff kidding? What was?
Yeah, of course, I'm kidding. There's no way I couldn't do it either. We told the story, but was a kid. We had our dogs caught a bunch of baby rabbits, and then they were like peanut size.
Yeah.
And they were writhing and they'd been, you know, punctured and bleeding. There's no way the mother was dead. There was no way. So I had to dispose of them. And the only way I knew how is with a shovel. And so and I was a kid. Now that was like the worst thing I've ever done in my entire life.
It's like almost like Where the Red Fern Grows by Jeff Carlin.
Right.
But with peanut sized baby rabbits.
Yeah.
That's really heartbreaking.
It was awful.
That is.
Really? Did you sit there on the banks of a river and stare off into the sunset after that was over?
Yeah, something like that.
It was tough, okay?
Yeah.
But you know what was really tough? Back when I was in high school, my friends and I would go to my house when my parents weren't there. Okay, so we party a little bit. And then throw goldfish to the lionfish. It was like the
Circle
big draw.
Life.
When we were like, yeah, somebody emailed me and said, Mr. Cass, I read your column, but what is Hakuna Matata?
Aww.
What?
What was I supposed to say to the guy?
What was the perceived age of this person? Not that,
I don't know.
That an ageist, but I mean, that might
you
explain.
You are so ageist.
That might explain the reference.
Maybe he doesn't have kids or something.
Right, that's something.
Or maybe he doesn't like Disney movies. I hate Disney movies.
Or he hates cartoons, and hence hates America.
Have you seen any good cartoons? You who are so wise in the ways of cartoons?
You mean animated films?
Yes, animated films.
Of course, yeah. Pixar does great work. Sometimes they've had a couple of clunkers, which is weird lately. But Pixar almost always comes up with amazing, amazing stuff.
You know, you're the guy to talk. I can't believe I never asked him this question. There's a technique of animated film that I really like. It's kind of like shaky looking, as if they're painting on glass and shooting through the glass. I love that look. What's that called? What is that?
Is this their palette? It's a translucence. It's they're talking about the new film. Another senior moment. Valid.
Senior moment.
No,
your hair's darker than mine.
Well, that's not. That's the only thing that's still youthful. Jeff, what's it? Valid. Oh God, it's a new film. It just came out.
Valerian?
Oh, Valerian.
Is that what you're talking about? Have you seen the trailer for this thing?
No, it was the girl in Charlie in. Was the girl a lingerie model, yes or no? That's what I want to know.
I don't think so.
The star?
Yeah, the star.
I have no idea.
Okay. So anyway.
Anyway, that's a sumptuous looking film. But can I change subjects real quick?
Yeah,
because
please.
I've been dying to ask someone like you this question.
Oh, like
No. This is
type.
No. Stay with me on this. I've been in the city. We're coming up on 9 years.
Uh-huh.
The Tribune. So I'm not. I love Chicago.
You want to move to a tiny house under the windmills in Rensselaer like me?
I'd love to.
Yeah.
Actually, but
165 square feet.
Well, that's the question I wanted to ask you. I mean, I'm not of Chicago. You're of Chicago. Born and raised. It's in your blood. You really are. You're a Chicagoan. When we first got to know each other, that's the reason I called. You're the second person I called when I got this job. But because of the taxes are going through the roof, the corruption continues unabated. I'm not sure.
Do we stay or do we go?
Do you stay or
do we fight or do we bolt?
Yeah,
that's a good idea for a column.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Fight or flight. You know.
Well, let's see. You've got
Chicago way.
You got on one side, and I'm not trying to piss off all the colleagues of mine and all their friends in the CTU, the SIU, and all the other unions, because I know they're out there. But do we work for them? I'm just wondering, not as journalists, but as taxpayers.
Well, apparently, yes.
Well, we work for the banks that pay their union pensions.
Right. So we are paying, correct? Mm-hmm. So that they can have good pensions. That's really what the tax fight is about, right? Partly.
Mm-hmm.
Do we stay or do we go?
What's your answer? I mean, you love Chicago. You do. I mean, I mean, it's in your
marrow. I live in Cook County. I could live in outside of Cook County, which I should because of that Tony Taxwinkle and her soda pop tax going after my lemonada. I hate that. By San Pellegrino, the lemon with a little shot of vodka. Oh, yeah, baby.
Good stuff.
That's how I do it. on the deck, looking at my row of onions with a little hole in it where the baby rabbits were. But
the rabbit refuge?
The rabbit refuge, yeah. But I think, what do you guys think? I mean, can we keep paying the taxes?
We can't. You can't live here. I mean, I'm thinking not just the taxes, but the corruption, the violence. I mean, it's just...
Wait a second. I keep reading, I think in the Tribune, that the Republicans who joined the Democrats, this is not the editorial board, but others... Mm-hmm. The Republicans who joined the Democrats were virtuous people. They're good. We should raise taxes. It's not bad. We don't really pay a lot of taxes. Who needs those taxes? Just keep paying.
Well, no.
Because government, we need Tony Preckwinkle and John Cullerton and all these people to run things. And then if I talk like that, you think I'll be on more radio stations? Jeff Carlin. Anyway, go on.
No, that's a question I'm asking you and just other people who I consider in my small circle true Chicagoans, people who are
what do they say?
Chicago. They're all thinking of leaving. I mean, and these are people who don't think like you and I politically. These are people who, you know.
Oh, they voted Democrat,
yes.
And now they're taken off.
Yeah.
After they empowered the Reavers and the Raiders.
Yes.
And I'm not saying I was a Democrat once. I just can't handle the corruption and the big government and the taxes.
I never was. I never was a Democrat. I voted for four Democrats in my entire life. Only because they were more conservative than the Republicans they were running against.
Look, my family was Democratic at one point, so much so that we had a mule named Truman.
No.
A white mule named Truman. And my dad would plow with it, and my grandfather would plow with it in our fields in the old country. Named after the President of the United States. They were given a mule as part of the Marshall Plan, a tall, beautiful, long-legged, black mule. My grandfather, my Papu John, not the other one, Papu John saw it and said, I don't like this mule. Too tall, too long-legged. So he went and traded another guy, got a mule that was shorter legged, bigger head, mean biter and kicker. And he called it Truman. One time it almost kicked my dad's head off.
Dang.
He was wiping the flies off its leg and the thing off the plow. He plowed. This is my father, one generation removed. My father's plowing our fields. That's what I love to hear. Some of you liberal jerks out there talking about Cass and his privilege. I'd really like to sometimes just kick you where I shouldn't.
As they're swatting the flies away from your legs.
So just someday I'll tell you about what happened. He's wiping the flies off, trying to brush them away, and the mule lets off a kick and kicks the top of my dad's head.
Oh, my God.
And you know what? He fell down into the field, and my aunt was there. She was running to help him, and he said, you know what? Maybe I'll tell you another time because we're running out of time. Okay? This has been the Chicago Way. If you want to know about how the mule kicked my dad in the head and turned us all into conservatives, you'll have to come back next week. For Jeff Carlin, Scott Stanis of the Chicago Tribune, and Tom Bevan, publisher and co-founder of the Real Clear Politics Empire, come back again for another time at the Chicago Way.